So let me welcome you to Christchurch Clifton. What I hear you wonder aloud, does Clifton Bristol have in common with Pittsburgh, with Nagoya, an hour's flight north of Tokyo, Long Beach, California, San Francisco, Barcelona? Well, what Clifton has in common with all those places is they're all places that our speaker this evening has already spoken this year. So we're going to be listening to a very well-travelled individual. But it's my pleasure as the vicar here at Christchurch to welcome you to the building and to say what a pleasure it is for us to host this Christians in Science event. I have here an interesting historical document relating to Professor Sir Colin Humphreys. Colin became Professor of Materials Science and Metallurgy at Cambridge in 1990, a year before I moved to Cambridge to take up a rather smaller orbital post as chaplain of one of the colleges. And I happened to find myself, and I still can't really work out why it might have been, reading the quarterly journal of the Royal Astronomical Society. And in it, I came across Professor Colin Humphreys for the first time in an article he'd written proving that demonstrating that the birth of Jesus Christ happened on the 25th of April, 5 BC. So I realized that the next year, 1993, the 25th of April was a Sunday. And if you want to check out the document, here's my term card for that Easter term. And April 25th, Professor Colin Humphreys, and the title of his talk was Christmas Day? And it was very well attended. And since then, we've kept in contact. Colin very kindly came and gave a couple of talks in my previous diocese on the book he wrote on Exodus, which is still the most fascinating read, and of course on his work on the last week of the life of Jesus. So it's a particular pleasure this evening personally to welcome him. And just before I hand over to Andrew, another professor who's going to introduce Colin in a more detailed way. And finally, this would be a very good time to turn off your mobile phones. If you're not familiar with the Church of England, if your mobile phone does go off during the course and event in one of our churches, you'll be seized by the vergers and escorted from the building, where in line with company policy, you'll be forgiven. So do enjoy the evening, and let me hand over to Andrew.
Thank you very much, Paul. I was just turning off my mobile phone because I'd forgotten to. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you very much, Paul, for welcoming us. And it is a great pleasure to have Colin with us, and I'm going to say a little more about him in a moment. But for those of you who don't know me, I'm Andrew Hailstrap, and I'm actually National Chairman of Christians in Science. And it's a particular privilege to have Colin here because he is our President of Christians in Science. Of course, I don't do nearly so much locally. Tina is our local rep, and she does all the work. So it's rather nice for me to be able to stand up here and know that she's done all the work that's made it possible. So thank you very much, Tina. If you don't know about Christians in Science, I hope you may have seen the rolling PowerPoint. But we engage with the interface between science and faith. And the majority of our members are actually professional scientists who are committed Christians. But we also like as events tonight to engage with the wider church community on issues relating to science and faith. And that's very much what we're doing tonight. And we run a whole series of lectures, if you don't know about us, locally as well as nationally. And next term, and in fact for the whole next 2 years, we've got a very good series coming up called Our Fragile Planet, A Christian Perspective. And we've got people speaking on a whole load of different aspects of caring for our planet. So it is a real pleasure to introduce Colin. We're very fortunate to have him. He's a man of great distinction. Distinction both in the scientific world, but also as a Christian communicator on science and faith. Just a few facts that I picked up from his CV. He's a professor of materials science and director of research at Cambridge University. He was president of the Institute of Materials, Minerals and Mining in 2002 and 2003. He's received numerous awards, including a CBE in 2003 for services to science as a researcher and communicator. And he was knighted in the 2010 birthday honors. He's also a fellow of both the Royal Society and a fellow and of the Royal Academy of Engineering. Now, Colin's research interests are really very broad. And I thought, before he lectures to us on the topic we have tonight, science and the historicity of the Bible, it would be good if, Colin, you'd just come up and give us an insight, briefly, into some of your research, because it really is quite impressive, and I think it'd be good if people got a feel for your science. So perhaps if you'd like to come up now, and then tell us a little, and then I'll pray for us, and then we'll go into your other lecture, if that's okay.
Well, thank you very much, Paul, and thank you, Andrew, for those very kind introductions. Right, about my own research. Well, in recent years, I've been researching something which most of you will be very familiar with, and that's light-emitting diodes, LEDs. And these are these replacement low-energy light bulbs that you can buy in shops now. And I've been trying to develop, to improve their efficiency, to understand how they work, because it's a material called gallium nitride, which it seems unlike any other material. It has very curious properties. And one is it emits brilliant light, even though the quality of the material is dreadful. It's full of defects. And so we've been trying to understand that. And then I've been doing some work to make these devices cheaper. So you know the cost is falling of LEDs all the time. And perhaps what I've been doing has helped to contribute to that. And our idea has been taken up by industry in the UK. So a company called Plessey, which used to be a very big company, then it disappeared, and it started up again, and they've taken on our technology, and they're manufacturing these LED chips in Plymouth, employing over 100 people to do this. And then looking to the future, I'm very keen on working on deep ultraviolet LEDs, because if you get the right energy, you can kill or stop reproducing all bacteria and all viruses. So a bit more technically, if you like, this deep ultraviolet radiation of just the right energy, it damages what's called nucleic acid, which is in both DNA and RNA, and that's in both bacteria and viruses. It stops them reproducing. So our hope is that this will be used in the future to purify water in the developing world and save millions of lives, and it will probably also be used to purify the water in our world, because it will actually be better than chlorine for doing this. And then something very recent, just this year, and I'll finish, is I've got involved in predicting earthquakes. I had a very good research student, and we found a new way of predicting earthquakes in the laboratory, which will give, instead of, you get a 10-second warning now of earthquakes, this will give a 1 week's warning of earthquakes. And this is just in the laboratory, so we need to see if this is going to happen in the real world with earthquakes. And I had an email from my research student this morning to say they've been looking at earthquake signals from Vancouver Island, earthquakes there in the past, and this is called machine learning way of predicting earthquakes. This appears, he thinks it's going to work for this real earthquake. So we're very confident, or quietly confident, this is going to work. So this is what I'm working on at the moment. Thank you.
Well, as you can see, we are very fortunate to have a very eminent scientist, and it's very exciting. So thank you for that, Colin. So let's just pray for this evening. Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for the wonder of your creation and the gift of science, that as we explore it, we can understand more of how you're at work in the world. And we thank you too for the Bible, your word revealed in Scripture. And we pray tonight, as Colin illuminates some aspects of things that happen in the Bible which may have a scientific explanation, we pray that you'll enable us to learn and be encouraged and excited by what he has to say. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. Colin, over to you now for your lecture.
Thank you. Well, great. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight. And I'd like to start by thanking Christina Biggs, who's organized this event and so successfully. And thank you all for turning out on really a cold evening to come here. And Christina suggested the title of this talk. And let me start by just asking this question. Does it matter if the Bible is reliable? And I think it does, because two reasons, really. One is that Christianity and also the Jewish faith, they have their roots in history. Right, we don't believe some vague, airy-fairy set of beliefs. Our beliefs are rooted in history. And that's why the Bible matters, because the Bible tells us or purports to tell us about the history of Israel and then the history of Jesus. Some people call it his story that the Bible talks about. But many people, of course, are very skeptical of what the Bible says. And so we need to ask this question, is the Old Testament purely fiction, which a number of people believe, Or is it a fictional matrix with a bit of history embedded in? Or is it a major historical content? And clearly, the Old Testament isn't all history. The Book of Psalms isn't all history, although it may contain history. And it's not written like a modern history book. A modern history book tends to have the chronology there, and then the history is built around that. But the Old Testament contains, if we read the Old Testament, a lot of history. And the question is this reliable history? Is a record reliable? And of course, the person who we believe, if we're Christians, has revealed God to us the most is Jesus. This is the greatest revelation of God to us. But nearly all we know about Jesus is from the Bible. And so again, is the Bible record reliable? So these are questions which Christians should ask, and of course non-Christians should ask as well. They're key questions for our faith. So I've looked at a number of books on the reliability of the Bible, and most of them, they're largely personal convictions, which are fine for Christians, but perhaps not quite so fine for non-Christians. So for example, you read books on the reliability of the Bible, and you read, why should we trust the Old Testament? And the answer usually given is because Jesus quoted extensively from the Old Testament, as he did, and Jesus quotes with authority, and so Jesus clearly believed this to be the Word of God, and therefore we should believe it to be the Word of God. And of course, for Christians, that's a good argument, but for non-Christians, it probably isn't a good argument. And so what I try to do is to look at the evidence, and particularly if there's any scientific evidence we can bring to bear, because theologians are often not aware of the scientific evidence, so that if we try and bring that in as well. And what I decided to do is something maybe a bit different. I'm going to look at three case studies, and I picked them out to be, I think, particularly challenging, and that's why I personally have had an interest in them. And so we're going to look at the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis, and see if that seems to be reliable. And then I want to look at the crossing of the River Jordan and see if that seems to be historically reliable. And then since Tina, this is something that's very recent, since Tina, I think, mentioned this maybe in the abstract, I'm going to look at this remarkable and puzzling passage in the book of Joshua, that Joshua prayed for the sun to stand still, and the sun stood still so the Israelites could beat their enemies. And also the day was extended, so it gave them enough time to beat their enemies. So we'll have a look at that. Things I'm not going to talk about, because they were mentioned in Christina's abstract, was the Star of Bethlehem, because there just isn't time. But as Andrew said, I have published on this, and I bought 20 reprints at the back. So if you'd like to take them, that of course they're absolutely free, and just take them away. About the Gospels, I'm also not going to talk about that because, again, that would just take too long. There's not time to fit that into the time available. But I have looked at apparent discrepancies in the four Gospels about the last week of Jesus and given possible solutions to these apparent discrepancies. And I wrote some book on that called The Mystery of the Last Supper. So what I want to do is to just look at these Old Testament challenges. And as we'll see, many modern scholars, they really question their historicity. And in fact, many modern scholars, they're much more willing to believe ancient Egyptian literature or ancient Babylonian literature than they are ancient biblical literature. So we'll have a look at that. So to start with, this is the story of Joseph. And it's really, when I wrote this talk just very recently, I was amazed to see myself how much of Genesis the story of Joseph occupies, right? Chapters 30 to 50, 40% of the book of Genesis. And I've just put up here on this slide just a few details. There are many, many more. It's a very, very detailed story. So let's have a look at it, and let's see why historians and biblical scholars question it. So Joseph, you may remember, he was Jacob's favorite son, and he wasn't the firstborn. So this is highly unusual. In the ancient world, not only ancient Israel, also Egypt, ancient Babylon, the firstborn son was always a favorite. So this is really unusual. He wasn't the favorite. He was born late in life to Joseph. And you may know that there was this famous coat of many colors, and probably not a brilliant translation, but he had this very ornamental coat, which was probably very rare and very valuable. And his brothers were very jealous of him because of the favoritism his father showed him. And so when they got the opportunity, they sold him for a slave, and they sold him for 20 shekels of silver, is what the book of Genesis says. And then he was taken to Egypt, And he was sold to an Egyptian official called Potiphar. And he was obviously a very handsome, well, I say obviously, probably a very handsome man, a young man, a strong man. And his wife, this is Potiphar's wife, tried to seduce Joseph. And Joseph said, no, you're a married woman. I'm not going to be seduced by you. And she tried several times. And then she got extremely annoyed that he rejected her advances. And so she said to her husband and others, Joseph has tried to seduce me. And so Joseph was unjustly thrown into jail, is what the story says. And when he was in jail, he met the cupbearer of Pharaoh. And the cupbearer of Pharaoh had been put in jail by Pharaoh for doing something wrong. And the cupbearer had a dream, a very unusual dream. And he said to Joseph, I had this unusual dream. I've got no idea what it means. And Joseph interpreted the dream for him. So the cupbearer was very impressed. And then the cupbearer was released. He went back to the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh had this unusual dream. And it's something, a story some of you will know, that he dreamt that out of the Nile came seven cows. And they were very sleek cows. They were very, very fit, very well-fed cows. And they were followed by seven scraggy, scrawny, lean cows. And the lean cows ate these very well-nourished other seven cows. And Pharaoh asked all the wise men in Egypt to interpret this dream, and he wasn't happy with any of the interpretations. And the cupbearer then said to Pharaoh, I now remember when I was in jail, I met someone called Joseph, and he interpreted my dream. Why don't we ask Joseph to interpret your dream? So Pharaoh gets Joseph out of jail, tells him this dream, and Joseph interprets it, and he says, this dream means that you'll have 7 years of magnificent harvest, followed by 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh says, well, that's terrible. If there's 7 years of famine, no one's going to survive. Lots of people are going to die. What shall we do? And Joseph says to Pharaoh, what you need to do is to, when you have the 7 years of plenty, build big barns and store all this grain in it so that you're prepared for the 7 years of famine. So you stock 7 years worth of grain for when the famine comes. And Pharaoh is convinced this is the right interpretation. He's so impressed, he makes Joseph his second in command. And Joseph then does exactly this. And the story continues. It's a very, very detailed story. Now, what do we make of this story? Well, these are two very distinguished historians and biblical scholars. This is Redford, who says that Joseph's story shows all the hallmarks of a composition that's a construction, if you like, a story, a sort of fairy story, rather than a record. That's in his book, Egypt, Canaan, and Israel in Ancient Times. And Elstrom says that Joseph's story is not history, just as, for instance, Shakespeare wrote about Richard III, a biblical writer could compose a story about Joseph and his brothers in Egypt. So it's a composition. It's like Shakespeare writing about Richard III. And this is just widely believed by a lot of biblical scholars, and certainly people who are historians and not Christians. So why do they think it's a myth? Well, there are good reasons for thinking this. And the first reason is, it's inconceivable. If you know about ancient Egypt, the pharaohs were all powerful. And it seems inconceivable an Egyptian pharaoh would appoint a non-Egyptian as their second in command. So that's the first reason, which appears to be a good reason. And then the next reason is, it's believed the story, widely believed the story is written at least 1,000 years after the supposed events. So someone writing 1,000 years later, can they really get the story right? Right? There's no internet, right? No typewriters for these sort of records. Can they really get the details of these stories correct, or even the main points? So can it be accurate after 1,000 years? And then the third reason for not believing it is that a seven-year famine in Egypt is highly improbable. And the reason for this is Egypt owes its wealth to the regular flooding of the River Nile. And the Nile would flood year after year after year. And occasionally, it wouldn't flood to the same level. And in fact, the priests of the temple, they were wonderful tax gatherers. They had something called Nilometers. You can go to Egypt, see them today. And they taxed according to the level of the River Nile. So we have some records over some periods of time. And they collected taxes. And about 1 year in 10, the Nile didn't flood properly. And that seems to be, you know, a sort of random event when the snow wasn't very great on the mountains at the source of the Nile. So the chances of two consecutive years of there being the Nile not flooding was about 1 in 100. 3 consecutive years, 1 in 1,000. So 7 years about famine, extremely improbable. So these are good reasons which we need to take into account. And I just put up here, if you look at what many evangelical Christians do, and many of evangelical Christians, you know, are in this room, they tend to ignore these criticisms. And I think that's probably the wrong approach. And I think, you know, you should look at these criticisms and take them seriously and engage with them. So that's what we're going to try to do with this. And let's see if science can help. So I got quite interested in this a number of years ago. And a key question, of course, is if Joseph was a historical character, when did he live? And we wrote a paper on this. I wrote with someone called Bob White, who's very involved with Christians in Science. And it was published in a geology paper, as well as Science and Christian Belief. And so we supported this argument to start with, that a 7-year famine in Egypt was highly unlikely because of the regularity of the flooding of the River Nile. So if we discount that, then how can we account for a 7-year famine? And we could only think of one reason for a famine of that duration. And it's interesting that the Bible says it wasn't just in Egypt, this famine, it was in the neighboring lands. So the reason we could think of was a massive volcanic eruption. And what happens in a massive volcanic eruption is that the temperature's lowered, that there's dust in the sky, the sun is darkened, so you don't get much sunlight. A lot of acid comes out of the volcano, which comes down as acid rain, and that destroys the seed and so on. And the biggest volcanic eruption going back for at least 10,000 years was in 1628 BC. It's believed to have been Santorini, but that's not totally certain. But we know there's a massive volcanic eruption then because of tree rings. So there's a tree ring record, it's called dendrochronology. So every year you get tree rings form as annual rings. And when there's a famine, right, then the tree rings are exceptionally narrow. And 1628 BC, the tree rings are exceptionally narrow. And in fact, we know this is a massive volcanic eruption because they are actually narrow for about 7 years in the tree ring record. And then you can look at ice records. So you take cores through ice in Greenland, and you see these sulfur deposits, right, which come from the volcanic eruption. And this date of 1628, it's an accurate date to within a year because you can count back the annual tree rings. And we know that the volcanic ash from this eruption fell on Egypt because we've got traces of the volcanic ash that people have found. So very tentatively, this is very tentative, and you build the story up, very tentatively, we say, what happens if this 7-year famine was due to this volcanic eruption, which we know was in 1628 BC? What is interesting is, in 1628 BC, there were pharaohs in Egypt which were foreign pharaohs. It was conquered by a foreign country, and it was called the Hyksos kings. There were 6 of them. And they reign from about, it's on the board here, from the screen, 1648 to 1540 BC. And they were hated afterwards by the Egyptians, who the Egyptians conquered them afterwards. They destroyed all their records. But we know those were the Hyksos kings. And what we can say is, although it's extremely unlikely that an Egyptian pharaoh would appoint Joseph as a deputy, it is rather likely that a Hyksos king, who was not an Egyptian, would appoint a non-Egyptian as their deputy. So we can see that the timing of the this particular timing of this period of history where the Hyksos, these foreign kings were ruling Egypt, fits very nicely into the Joseph story. Now I should also say, if you look at the biblical record of dates, this date of 1628 BC for Joseph is an extremely plausible date. So these are the foreign kings, which we've just said. It's totally plausible that this foreign Hyksos pharaoh would have appointed Joseph as deputy. And now I think we come to, let's just have a look to start with, dating the Genesis text. Let's take on this argument about, you know, written about 1,000 years after the event. So one point is, how do we date the text in Genesis, or any ancient text? And the first thing is, it is extremely difficult. And one thing you do is to look at the language in the text, because language is out over time, and you compare it with other texts that you can date. And the problem is there are extremely few other Hebrew texts outside the Old Testament at that sort of date, so it is very difficult. There's various scholars. Alan Millard is a scholar I've got huge confidence in. He was professor of Hebrew and ancient Semitic languages at the University of Liverpool. He dates the Hebrew of the Genesis text to between 700 and 600 BC. So it is about, that Hebrew is about 1,000 years after the events we're talking about. Other people date it later than that. We know that the Hebrew text, the whole Hebrew text, must have been there by the 3rd century BC, because Hebrew scholars, Jewish scholars in Alexandria translated the Hebrew Bible into the Greek Bible called the Septuagint at that time. But then a lot of those Hebrew manuscripts have subsequently been lost. But then we know they must have existed at that time. So this is the problem. If Joseph was alive in 1628 BC, and the texts of Genesis are, say, 600 BC, that's 1,000 years gap after the events recorded. But what we've done in this process, we've dated the language of the earliest Hebrew Genesis texts we have, but that doesn't mean that's when they were written. And why it doesn't mean that's when they were written is that there were scribes who were trained to copy and reproduce things really accurately over time. And all they would do, they would update the language, right? So it's rather like modern Bibles. Modern Bibles, you know, the translation of the Bible in 100 years' time will use the English in 100 years' time. And scribes would translate faithfully, but they'd update the grammar so people would understand it. And so if we have something that we find, and the language is, say, 600 BC, that means that was the last updating of the scribes, but it could have been considerably earlier, the original text. And you'll know that traditionally Moses is one of the authors of the first five books of the Bible, and I don't see any reason to doubt that he was an author. There may well have been other authors as well contributing, but I don't see any reason to doubt that. And I've just quoted here from what Kenneth Kitchen says in his book called On the Reliability of the Old Testament, and he says, consider Moses writing a papyrus on skins, etc. Copies of originals would have been recopied, modernizing outdated grammatical forms and spellings, a process universal in the ancient Near East. So not just Hebrew documents, Egypt documents, Babylonian documents, and so on. And he says, experienced scribes were able to transmit very accurate copies of work for centuries. And so, as you said, the earliest texts of Genesis have a language you can date to, say, 600 BC. The lost original texts may be much older. And I'll just give an example of a book I've got at home. So I have at home a book called William Shakespeare, The Complete Works. And I opened it up, and it says inside, Tudor edition, first published 1951. Right? And so, but we know Shakespeare didn't write in 1951. And how do we know? Because the language is earlier than 1951. And we know that Shakespeare lived earlier than that. But these were edited at that later date. And how do you find out when Shakespeare wrote them? Well, by trying to compare the language he used with other things and by dating Shakespeare himself. But you may well be thinking, quite rightly, this is just speculation that there were earlier texts than 600 BC. Well, interestingly, I think the next slide will show it's probably not just speculation. And okay, the next slide doesn't show this. So this the next slide after this one will. This just says, suppose you find a text of Genesis and an ancient library, and the library was put up there in 3 BC. And Hebrew and spelling, you know, you can date to 700 BC, but it might have been revised and updated, and it's just standard practice. Now, this is the key thing, and this is the argument which should be much better known, because it's a very nice argument. It was from Ken Kitchen, who's this great specialist, professor of Egyptology. And what Kenneth Kitchen has shown is that the price of slaves was subject to inflation. Nearly everything is, right? You know, the price for a loaf of bread is subject to inflation. You know that butter's going up in price, bread's going up in price. Almost everything is, right? Silicon chips come down in price, a great exception. And in the ancient world, potato chips go up in price, silicon chips come down. In the ancient world, the price of slaves went up over time. And Kenneth Kitchen has shown that not only in the Bible, but also in Egypt and in Babylonia, the price of slaves is actually much the same. And we have a record from these, you know, three countries of what it was. And this is the record, which you can find in the ancient text. So in this period, 1700, 1600 BC, the price was 20 shekels of silver. 1400, 1300 BC, it was 30 shekels of silver. 700 BC, 50 shekels of silver. 400 BC, 100 shekels of silver. So what price is said in the Genesis record? It says Joseph was sold for 20 shekels of silver. So the point is this. If this document was actually written in 700 BC, then wouldn't they have said he was sold for 50 shekels of silver? How could they have known that it was 20 shekels of silver way back in time? So it's really quite a powerful argument, I think, that the original text or the oral tradition or whatever, which was faithfully transmitted, takes you back to the real price of slaves in 1700 to 1600 BC, which is when the Hyksos pharaohs were reigning and when there was this massive volcanic eruption, which would have caused a major famine. So I think this is now, you know, the whole story now becomes consistent. And if the story was invented and first written in 700 BC, then 50 shekels of silver would have been used. So this suggests, I think, the original story really does date back to that date and has been faithfully transmitted by scribes who just updated the language. But again, this really strongly suggests this is a faithful historical record. So this, I think, repeats those main points. Is the story of Joseph historical? Well, we know there's a famine of about 7 years from the tree rings. They show that there's this exceptionally narrow tree ring growth for about that period of time in 1628 BC. And this was a time of the Hyksos pharaohs. Joseph was sold as a slave for 20 shekels of silver, if the story has been invented. So I think this Joseph story actually shows all the hallmarks of being historical, the original text being copied faithfully by scribes over the centuries, who not only did this with biblical texts, but it was standard practice throughout the ancient Near East on texts of Egypt and Babylon and so on. So, and a bit like modern Bible translation. So I think we can say, you know, reasonable plausibility, this is a historical document. Right, this is another story. This does appear. Some of you may have heard this before, because you've heard me speak about the Exodus. So this is the second example, crossing the River Jordan. This is the last miracle in the Exodus story, when the Israelites go into their promised land of Canaan, recorded in the biblical book of Joshua. And this is what the book of Joshua says. It's a very simple, succinct account. Now, it's two verses in the book of Joshua. Now, the Jordan in flood or during harvest. And as soon as the feet of the priest touched the water's edge, the water from upstream of the Jordan stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Araba, that's the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. And the Israelites crossed over opposite Jericho. Now, you can picture the scene. The Israelites are on one side of the River Jordan. The Jordan's not flowing normally because it's in flood. So it's a particular barrier. And we'll see a photograph of the Jordan later. You'll just see what a barrier it would have been. And they're on one side of the Jordan. They can see on the other side the land of Canaan, which in modern terms is modern Israel and modern Palestine. Israel plus Palestine is ancient Canaan. And they've waited 40 years, about 40 years, to get to their promised land. And they can see it, but the situation looks hopeless because there's this rushing torrent of water separating them from Canaan. And then suddenly, this river stops flowing. And it just must have been an amazing sight. And the river stops flowing, and so they can cross. And they cross over in triumph. It's like someone has a big tap, and they've just turned the tap off, and the water stops flowing. And so the question is this story historical or not? And most people, and again, most biblical scholars, think it's a legend because it seems unbelievable. And again, that's not an unreasonable reaction, right? It really does seem to be an unbelievable story. It seems like a children's story. So some of you may have been to Israel, and you may have seen the River Jordan, and you know it's extremely narrow now. And the reason is that since about 1940, both the state of Israel and the state of Jordan have taken huge amounts of water from the River Jordan for irrigation purposes, and so it's very narrow. And when I saw the River Jordan, I just thought, why didn't they swim across? You know, it's like from me to the front row of seats there. So a lot of water has been taken for irrigation purposes. But if you go back before 1940, it really was a wide river, and it's particularly wide in spring because the snow on Mount Hermon melts, and that's the source of the Jordan, and the flood water comes down in a rushing torrent. And this next slide, if the slides are okay, are okay for this slide. So this is a picture taken in the 19th century of the Jordan in flood. You can just see it's a huge barrier. And there was an expedition, to the Jordan in the 19th century, and the Jordan in flood was described as being half a mile wide, right? So it's a massive barrier. They couldn't swim across. It was flowing very rapidly. So that's the river that the Israelites crossed. That's the river that stopped flowing. So can it be true? And it does sound impossible and implausible. So there's a strange detail of the story, and we have to say, to start with, is it historical fiction? It comes across as being, the writer wants to be factual because he identifies very carefully a lot of places. But what did the writer intend, and what would his audience have thought he meant? There is this very curious detail in this account of the crossing of Jordan. And this is a curious detail, that if the story had been invented, I think the writer would have said that the priests came up to the edge of the River Jordan, and as their feet touched the River Jordan, the water piled up by their feet. It doesn't say that. It says the water piled up a great distance away. And that's really strange, because the writer's saying the miracle didn't happen where they were, it happened somewhere else. It happened a great distance away. And he's at pains then to point out where it was. He said a great distance away at a place called Adam. And in case you don't know where that is, it's in the district of Zarathan. So he really tries to pinpoint where this miracle occurred, but it wasn't where the Israelites were. And again, if this story had been invented and made up, I think the writer almost certainly would have said the miracle happened where the priests were. It would be much more, in a sense, dramatic to have said that. But and I think, you could say, how did the writer know? Well, I think, these people like us, we're inquisitive. And if, let's say, this had happened to us, we marched across, the leader might have said, this is a remarkable event, let's see where it happened. And he would have sent some of his troops to go upstream, said, John and Jones, are you, go upstream and find out what's happened. And then they went upstream, they went to this place called Adam, and they saw where the river had stopped flowing. And that's where they came back to say, it stopped flowing at this place called Adam. And Joshua Mayer said, where's Adam? They said, it's in the vicinity of Zarathan. So it all got written down. So the water, a miracle occurred elsewhere. Well, can we find out where this happened now, and can we find out what happened? So, as I've said before, there's a careful attention to the text, to the geography. We're told that the Israelites didn't just cross the Jordan, they crossed the Jordan opposite Jericho, and we're told where the water piled up in a heap at Adam in the vicinity of Zarathan. We're told all these places are upstream from the Dead Sea. So, if you look on a map now, as I have done, I've looked on a number of maps, and you won't find a place called Adam. And in a sense, that's not surprising, because most places which existed 3,000 years ago either don't exist now at all, or if they do exist, their names have changed. Occasionally, and rarely, the name hasn't changed. So Jericho is called Jericho now, and it was called Jericho 3,000 years ago. But that's an exception. And names keep changing. So you may know in India, a place called Mumbai today was called Bombay, some years ago. But even then, you can recognize Mumbai and Bombay have a linguistic similarity. And what sometimes happens is that when ancient Hebrew words change to modern Arabic words, there are certain linguistic rules, probably unwritten rules, which apply. And one rule is that if there's a breathing sound at the beginning of the word, that's dropped, but the consonants are usually retained. And ancient Jewish language was a consonantal language. It did not contain vowels. Only consonants were written. And if you thought of speaking it in your mind, you then inserted vowels in your mind. Or if you said it to other people, you inserted vowels. And we're doing the same today with text messages on mobile phones. So, if someone writes a text message, they put TXT in the message for text. And it should be pronounced text and not text or toxt or taxed. And that's what they did then. So they just inserted these vowels in the same sort of way. So where was Adam? Well, Adam would have been written as the Hebrew consonant for D, for D, followed by the Hebrew consonant for M, and it actually had this breathing sound in the front of it. And so if we want to look for ancient Adam on a modern map, we should look for a word which has these consonants which have been retained, the D and the M. And there is a place on a modern map, and it's on all modern maps, and it's called Damia, right? So there's a D and the M are retained, and this Arabic adding ending, Damia, has been added at the end. And it's 17 miles north of Jericho on the River Jordan. And I put here, most scholars are agreed that ancient Adam is modern Damia. And I haven't found a scholar who isn't agreed to this. So I think it is generally agreed by scholars. And this shows you a map of the situation. So it's a simplified map. So on the left-hand side is the Mediterranean Sea. And yes, it is your left, right? The Mediterranean Sea. And then you can see the Sea of Galilee at the top. And then the River Jordan comes down. And this is the Dead Sea at the bottom. And then you can see Jerusalem marked, and they cross the River Jericho opposite Jerusalem. Sorry, they cross the River Jordan opposite Jericho. Jerusalem's marked and Jericho's marked. Cross opposite Jericho. And upstream, you can see where modern Damia is, and that was ancient Adam. So the geography fits very nicely what the book of Joshua has described. And then this is where the science comes in. So this is where science can be really helpful in helping biblical interpretation in some cases. So this was a record of July 11th, 1927. There was an earthquake which shook Jericho and buildings collapsed and walls fell. And this was detected around the world. And it was 6.5 on the Richter scale. And just by comparison, there was this earthquake, many of you will remember the dreadful earthquake in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2011. And that was 6.5 on the Richter scale. And the earthquake in New Zealand was 6.3 on the Richter scale. So it's a logarithmic scale, but it's a very similar magnitude earthquake. And why did it occur in Jericho? And it occurred because of slippage along what's called the Jericho Fault. So if you go back to the map, there are tectonic plates. So geology is very interesting in this whole region. There's a tectonic plate on the right-hand side of the River Jordan. There's a tectonic plate on the left-hand side of the River Jordan. And these two plates are rubbing together, and it's a complex motion. They're actually pulling apart and also shearing up and down as well. And this gives rise to what's called the Great Rift Valley, which you can see from space. So this starts, I think, in Lebanon. It comes down through the Sea of Galilee, goes along the Jordan, through the Dead Sea. It then goes down the Gulf of Aqaba into the Red Sea and then tails around into Ethiopia. And so that's where you get lots of earthquakes recorded in the Bible, because this whole region around Jerusalem is an earthquake-rich zone. So this was a clue of the earthquakes, and this happened in July 11, 1927. And this is what Professor Neuer, who's an expert in the geography of this region and the geology, he works at Stanford University. I wrote him a letter. He wrote to me. I said, "Can I quote your letter?" He said, "Yes, you can." So this is what he wrote. He wrote, "During the 1927 earthquake, several ground cracks appeared together with an outpouring of groundwater. This soil liquefaction phenomenon has been well observed in earthquakes elsewhere. During the earthquake, mudslides occurred along the Jordan near Damia, about 30 kilometers, that's 18 miles, north of Jericho. These temporarily stopped the river's flow." So in this earthquake, mudslides occurred at Damia, which we know is ancient Adam, and they temporarily stopped the river's flow. The river had to build up behind the mudslide and either come over it or go around it. And that typically would take 1 to 2 days. And this is a photograph, not of the 1927 event, which stopped the River Jordan. This was a later event in 1957, which didn't stop the Jordan, but it almost did. Right? You can see the Jordan's not very wide because water's been taken from by Israel and Jordan. But you can see the earthquake-induced mudslide, and the River Jordan has just flowed around it. But you can well imagine a bigger earthquake-induced mudslide would have stopped the River Jordan totally. And then Professor Neuer wrote to me that this happened before 1927 on a number of occasions. He writes, "Adam is now Damia, the site of the 1927 mudslides which cut off the flow of the Jordan. Such cutoffs lasting typically 1 to 2 days, having also been recorded in 1906, 1834, 1546, 1534, 1267, and 1160. Then he says the stoppage of the Jordan is so typical of earthquakes in this region that little doubt should be left of the reality of such events in Joshua's time. So, is this crossing of the Jordan, is it historical? And what we've shown is that this story of the River Jordan stopping and then starting again some hours later, maybe a day later, it's far from being impossible because it's actually occurred. It's occurred a number of times in history. And we now know it's due to an earthquake, indeed mudslide in the region. So it is consistent with the book of Joshua saying the water piled up in a heap. It would have piled up in a heap behind this mudslide until it could get over the top. And the location of the heap of water is not nearby, as we said, but the Bible says it was at Adam, and we know that that's where this earthquake and these mudslides had occurred in recent times on a number of occasions. So there's a lot of evidence to say the story is historical. And just before I finish that part of the story, I'd like to say, some people say that in giving this explanation, I'm explaining away, or people believe it, are explaining away a miracle. And I'd like to say very strongly that that is not the case. The fact that you can explain how a miracle happened does not mean you explained it away. What you're saying is that God acted with and through the nature he created. And that's one way God can perform miracles. And it may be the normal way God performs miracles. He can, of course, break his own rules because a composer's free to break his own key signature in a piece of music. But and God sometimes, I believe, does that. But on these occasions, he's not breaking his own rules. The miracle is that it happened at just the time the Israelites were there. If it had happened a month before or a month after, it would not have been recorded in the book of Joshua. Wouldn't be recorded anywhere, I think. So this is a miracle. It's a miracle of timing. And it's a great lesson we can learn, I think, all of us, that God often works by timing. And I think he works often by timing today. And you can ask, how did he achieve this miracle of timing? Maybe one way was that Joshua was so attuned to the mind of God. So maybe as Joshua was leading the Israelites, God was saying to him, hurry up a bit, Joshua. Or, you know, slow down a bit. And maybe that's how the timing was achieved. But Joshua, I think, was an agent of God in this. And I think that is a story that we can learn from today, that if our minds are attuned to the mind of God, then we can be involved in these miracles of timing and be agents in these miracles of timing. I'll now look at my watch and come to the last. It's interesting. There are some words missing from this. I'll check afterwards what's happened. But this should say, did the sun stand still? This is what this should say. This event, and it's sometimes been called the most puzzling event in the Old Testament. And it's this passage in the book of Joshua, which seems to say that the sun stood still, and it's sometimes called the long day of Joshua. What the book of Joshua says is that Joshua prayed to God that the sun would stand still and that the moon would stop. And then later on, a few verses below that, it says that the sun did indeed stand still and the moon stopped until the Israelites could take vengeance on their enemies. So that's popped up there. And then the writer says, there has been no day like it before or since. So nearly everyone, including quite evangelical biblical scholars, find this very hard to believe. And so you get a variety of explanations for this. But, you know, people say it stretches credibility to the limit. And I think if you read the text, it doesn't. And we'll see why in a moment. But if it is historical, then what the writer is saying is something very special happened in the sky because there has been no day like it before or since. And this was, okay, written in a culture of the time, so we can say in his experience, like, there's been no day like it before or since. But that's a very important thing to say. Something really dramatic seems to have happened. I sometimes give talks on science religions, and about 1 in 3 of these talks, people say to me, what happened when the sun stood still? And I've always said, look, I'm sorry, I really don't know, but I'll think about it. And then I decided to think about it just earlier this year, again, and I decided to go back to what the Hebrew actually said, which of course is always a very good thing to do. And so the Hebrew for the sun standing still was a Hebrew word called dom, right? And this Hebrew word called dom, it actually is translated a number of ways in the Bible. It's sometimes translated as silent. It sometimes translates as stood still. It sometimes translated as stopped. And you have to say, what is meant if the sun was silent? Because if it's a cuckoo bird that's silent, it stops singing, right? It stops doing what it normally does. If the sun's silent, the sun doesn't normally make a noise. But what does the sun normally do? It shines. So if the sun's silent, does that mean the sun stops shining? And then you immediately think of an eclipse. And then I suggested this to Alan Millard. So I went back to Alan Millard, and I said, Alan, is a possible interpretation of these words in Joshua that the sun stopped doing what it normally does, and it might have been an eclipse? And those of us who are scientists in the audience will know that we have many good ideas, and we find out that someone's thought of them before. So Alan Millard said to me, he said, what you say is perfectly fine from the Hebrew. He said it could mean that the sun didn't stop moving, it stopped shining. So that's a totally valid interpretation of the Hebrew. But someone suggested this 100 years ago, and it's not a new thought. And this person was a linguist who worked at Princeton University, and he actually went further than this. And what he said was actually very interesting. This linguist at Princeton University, he said this word dom, which is translated stood still in the Hebrew or stopped, has the same root, again, the syllables, the consonants, as a Babylonian word, which is used in cuneiform texts to describe the astronomical event called eclipses. So the same root, the same word, same root in Babylonian terms is used to describe solar eclipses. And this scholar who is Robert Wilson in Princeton, he said it's a poor translation. It's a valid translation, this translation, but he said a better translation in light of the Babylonian is to say the sun was eclipsed. All English translations, the authorized version started by saying that the sun stood still, and all modern translations have followed it, the whole lot. I've looked at about 20, so they all say it. Okay, let's look at the scientific problems first. Right, so if we believe in an all-powerful God, then, and Christians here will believe in that, then we believe that God can do anything, and that is important. But it's equally important, I think, to say the key question is not what could not, but key question, not what could God do, it's what God did do, right? It's a key question to ask. And so let's try and look at that to see what God did. And so if you're a scientist, and even if you're not a scientist, what do you actually mean by saying the sun stopped moving? So we see the sun going around the earth, right? It actually goes around once every 24 hours. That's what we see. But actually what's happening is the sun's up there and the earth is rotating on its axis, right? Once every 24 hours. And, okay. And then a person on the equator, you can do the sums. Person on the equator, here's the sun going around. If you're on the equator, he's actually going around at 1,000 miles an hour. Now, he doesn't recognize this because the ground underneath him is going around at 1,000 miles an hour, and so everything's fine. Now, we're not on the equator. We're a bit off the equator, and we're actually going around. You people sitting in your seats, and I'm standing up. We're actually going around at 500 miles an hour, which is a remarkable thought because the ground underneath you is going around 500 miles an hour, and so, you know, you're static with regard to the ground underneath. So that's what happens, but if the Earth stops, then what happens then? We fly forward at 500 miles an hour. And it's like being, let's say you're on the roof rack of a car, and the car, okay, you're not usually on the roof rack of a car, right? But you're on top of a car, going along, you're holding on, and the car suddenly stops, you're thrown forward with the velocity that you had, or the velocity of the car. And so we'd be thrown off at 500 miles an hour. And not only that, there'd be huge tsunamis worldwide, right? The sea wouldn't stop moving because it can move. And so there'd be huge destruction of life. And as never seen before, actually. And so you might expect there to be some other records of this and some scientific evidence of this, and there is none, right? So this interpretation scientifically is extremely unlikely. And so that's why you say, can science, you know, help us out on this? And as we've seen, this is probably a poor biblical translation, which has happened, you know, ever since the Authorized Version. And if you then have an eclipse idea, yes, no destruction, no evidence of this. So this is what I've just been saying. Dom means to be silent, somewhat dumb or still. If the sun is silent, it means it stops emitting. This other word used, amad, also means to stop. I asked Alan Millard, so I've said all this before, right, so don't have to repeat it. And then this is what Robert Wilson said, and he said that the sun stood still should be translated the sun was eclipsed. So 100 years ago, someone followed up Robert Wilson's paper, and they said, it's a pity, but we can't do the calculations. We can't, you know, this event, whenever it happens, the 1000 BC, and we can't do these calculations. So nothing happened, the next thing to say is, where were Joshua and the Israelites when they observed this eclipse? And this eclipse, the sun stopping shining, this occurred shortly after the Israelites had crossed the Jordan and they'd defeated Jericho. And again, I inquired with Alan Millard, and he said it's almost certain in the same year. That's what the biblical record suggests, that they crossed the Jordan in the spring when it was in flood, and this was probably in the autumn, that sort of time in the same year. So they were in Canaan when this happened. And fortunately, which is always nice to have independent evidence, we have independent evidence that the Israelites were in Canaan. This is sometimes called the Israelite stela, but officially it's the Meneptah stela. Meneptah was the son of Ramesses the Great, who was a famous pharaoh, Ramesses II of Egypt. He was his son. And there's a large granite block, which is called the Meneptah stela, which is now in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And the stela says it was carved in his fifth year, and he gives a list of the people he conquered in his first 5 years. It's like, you know, a praise to the great pharaoh Meneptah. And in it, he said he had a campaign in Canaan in which he conquered the people of Israel. And it's quite interesting. The words he used are quite precise in Egyptian terms. He doesn't say the state of Israel because it wasn't yet established. He says the people of Israel. So they were still, you know, a bit nomadic and going around Canaan. But this is clear Egyptian evidence that they were in Canaan when he defeated them. So this shows that they must have been in Canaan by the fifth year of Meneptah. So when was the fifth year of Meneptah? Hopefully the next slide will show this. Right, so this is, again, quite recent scientific evidence that radiocarbon dating has been used to date the pharaohs in this dynasty 19, which includes Ramesses II of Meneptah. And the radiocarbon dating shows with a 95% probability, it's high probability, that the first year of his reign was the earliest possible date is 1231 BC, the latest possible date is 1207 BC. So if he defeated the Israelites in his first 5 years, then you can see, you add on 5 years to this period, this is the sort of period of time we're looking for if there was an eclipse. And so the question is, was there a solar eclipse in this period of time? Now, this should say, okay. Yeah, this should say that, again, because this was suggested by Robert Wilson, it's not my original idea, and someone called Sawyer in 1972 did eclipse calculations, following up this idea it was an eclipse, and he says there were two solar eclipses. He took a huge period of time from 1500 BC to 1050 BC, and in that period of time there were just two solar eclipses, total eclipses, visible from Canaan, and these are the dates he has, 1157 and 1131 BC. But both of these dates are too late for the Israelites to have just entered Canaan. So if we just go back to this slide, this was the first possible year of the reign of Meneptah. And if the Israelites were there in his first 5 years, then these dates are too late for them to enter Israel. And so biblical scholars have said this eclipse interpretation cannot be right, and so it sort of disappeared from their memory. And I then had a thought, or it is a new thought then, and that is, if you go to the ancient world, people didn't distinguish between total eclipses and annular eclipses. So in a total eclipse, the sun disk is totally covered by the moon. In an annular eclipse, the moon is also, as it were, totally covering the disk of the sun, but it's slightly slightly closer to the Earth, and so it doesn't, slightly further from the Earth, and so it doesn't, and you get a little ring called a ring of fire around. It's a very dramatic event. In modern astronomy, we distinguish between total, annular, and partial. In ancient astronomy, they had the same word for total and annular, and partial was a different word. So I thought, let's have a look at annular eclipses, and this should show us. Okay, but no, that's okay, that's fine. So this is, there's one and one only annular eclipse, which is quite nice, and that is 30th October, 12,007 BC. And this shows the eclipse track, and that's the Red Sea coming up from the bottom, and on the left-hand tributary going up to the top, as it were, is the Gulf of Suez, and the one going to the right-hand side a bit is the Gulf of Aqaba. And then that's the land of Canaan is above that. And there's a tiny circle, you may be able to see, maybe not from the back, but that's a place called Azekah, where they probably saw this eclipse from. And it's very central to the central track of this eclipse. And that's the only annular eclipse in the dates 1250 to 1050 BC. 1500, sorry, to 1050 BC. And this is what an annular eclipse looks like. So it's very dramatic. This was taken over New Mexico in 2012. And the sky's darkened, and you can see dusk apparently falls because of the low level of light falling on the situation. So that's what it would have looked like. So what about the long day of Joshua? Because it does imply the day was lengthened. The sun did not hurry to set for about a whole day. And I will just point out to you, I'm just looking at my watch guard, will just point out to you that there's been a myth circulating for a long time, and sometimes people will come up to me and they'll say, the long day of Joshua was explained. There was a NASA scientist, and the NASA people wound back the calculations. So they were trying to calculate forward positions of the sun and the moon. They went back in time, and they found they went back to, you know, over 1000 BC. There was a missing day. And some scientist who knew his Bible, working at NASA, said, I can explain this missing day. It's the long day of Joshua. And that was on the internet, very widespread, and it keeps reoccurring. And NASA's issued a statement to say it's totally untrue. So don't believe this urban myth. The guy was called Harold Hill. There really was not a missing day. But if we look at this, if we look at the illumination on the ground, so this is a plot of the illumination of the ground, the intensity of light, plotted on a logarithmic scale, because that's how our eye responds to light. And if you plot that as a function of time of the eclipse, the solid curve is the illumination on the ground from the eclipse, and the lighter curve is if there wasn't an eclipse. And what you see is, at maximum time of the eclipse, then the illumination on the ground is actually 10 times less than if the eclipse hadn't have happened. And what's actually happening there, the illumination drops to the level of dusk. So this eclipse happened in the afternoon, and then dusk apparently set in, and we know from other observations that when you have an annular eclipse or a total eclipse, both are fine for this, dusk apparently sets in, and the birds start to roost. And so out on the battlefield, they would have seen birds starting to roost. It would have appeared like dusk. It would have appeared that the day was ending, and they would have thought, we still haven't defeated our enemies. And then as the eclipse passed, the illumination increased, an extra daylight was provided, and it was as if there was another day. And so I believe that is what Joshua means by saying, if we go back and see what he says, that the sun did not hurry to set for about a whole day. And again, Alan Miller said, a better translator is as on a whole day. It was as if, you know, the sun hadn't set. So it was a double dusk. You had two dusks on that day. And I think this is a layman's description of what happened. And I think this explanation fits very well. So long day of Joshua due to a double dusk day. The first dusk, at the maximum of the eclipse, when the illumination on Earth fell to dusk, that happened at 4:50 p.m., and then birds would have roosted, and then the light level rose before there was a normal sunset at 5:38 p.m. So it would appear the day had been lengthened to the people out on the battlefield. They didn't have watches, remember. They looked at things like dusk. And this, just for interest, this is the appearance of the sun from this place called Attica, where we think they were, at 3-minute intervals. So you see how the eclipse is at its maximum, roughly in the middle of this picture, and then as the eclipse passes. But just a very dramatic observation, and you can well imagine Joshua say, this is the only annual eclipse in the period 1500 BC to 1050 BC. Really rare event. So Joshua saying there's been no day like it before or since. So this is very recent work. So this was published in an astronomy journal. So it's a journal of the Royal Astronomical Society. And I was keen to get the astronomer saying this was, you know, this is a real eclipse visible from Canaan. And so that's what they said. And what's very interesting is, I believe it's the oldest datable solar eclipse recorded. A few people say there are Chinese records before this, but when astronomers look into this, they say they're not eclipse records at all. They just refer to some unusual sunset or some unusual storm. And a great expert on ancient eclipses called Richard Seaman has said there is no recorded eclipse before 1000 BC. So if this is accepted as an eclipse record, it is the oldest recorded solar eclipse. It enables, I think, to interpret correctly this Book of Joshua's statement, the sun stood still. And what's interesting is that we can go back and we can sort of triangulate this information. So we can say that this occurred when the Israelites entered Canaan in their first year. So this occurred in 1207 BC, and that's when they entered Canaan. We can look at the record of Manetta saying that he conquered them within his first 5 years. And King Kitchen has analyzed the situation. He said it can't have been his years 1 or 5, so it's years 2, 3, or 4. We can use a radiocarbon dating as well, and we can use all those three methods. And I believe that we can identify the date of the reign of Manetta to within a year, and also of his father Ramesses II to within a year, because the dates of their reigns are known. So instead of doubting the historicity of the Bible on this, we can actually, if we accept the historicity of the Bible on this, we can actually improve the historicity of Egyptian chronology. So it's an interesting consequence, I think, of this. So we can actually improve the history of ancient Egypt. So this is conclusions. So we've taken three what I think are really very challenging passages in the Old Testament. And I hope in these cases I've shown to you, I believe that the Bible record is reliable. And this really, I think, does raise our expectations that the rest of the Bible is reliable. It's reliable on these difficult events. It does really raise expectations on some less difficult events. It's probably reliable as well. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, Colin, thank you very much. I rather suspect you had a Mac PC problem with your slides. Do you work with a Mac?
No, it's a PC, so I agree with you. Well, it could have been, but yes.
Anyway, but it didn't spoil it at all. It was fantastic. We've got some time for some questions. So I think Tina's going to come around with a roving mic. So if you put up your hand, she will... Oh, what's happening? Well, whilst we're just doing that, Colin, one of the things you mentioned, which was it's often a matter of timing, and you then alluded to a composer with a key signature. And I remember you saying something really helpful about how we see miracles.
Right.
And I wonder if you just say, because to me it was one of the most helpful analogies that I've heard. So would you be able just to say a bit
about that? Right, okay. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'd be pleased to say that. So this was, I gave a music analogy, and I said, that's why I'm looking around now. So I think that's probably an organ or like an organ there. But let's imagine that in this room there's a piano and organ, and someone's playing it, and you go and stand behind them, and they're playing it without music, and you watch what their fingers are doing, and you notice that every time they should go and play the key, the note F, the white ivory for F, they play the black note, F sharp. And you think, gosh, this is unusual. And then you realize that this is the key signature for the music. So if my memory is correct, this piece was written in the key of G major, and it's the instructions of the composer, so the pianist or the violinist, if the violinist, that instead of playing the note F, the white note F, you play F sharp. And so, in a sense, that's what scientists are trying to do, is to find the key signature of the universe, right? We look at how the universe operates, and we look at things repeated again and again and again, like playing an F sharp instead of F, and we say, okay, that's a key signature of the universe. And then the question is the composer, or is God, bound to follow the rules he's set up? And if you then continue to look at this pianist, you may find that occasionally, very occasionally, he doesn't play an F sharp, he or she plays an F. And very occasionally, they may play an A flat, or they may play a C sharp. And if you know something about music, you think, ah, the composer's put in an accidental. And he's just deliberately broken his rules and put in an accidental. And if it's a great composer, it's not a capricious act, it's because it makes better music. And I said, I think, probably when Andrew was listening, I've done this, I've gone home, and I've taken a great piece of music, and I played it without the accidentals and with the accidentals, and it's so much better with the accidentals in the music. And the accidents make... But the composer, because it's a composer, is free to do this. And if it's a great composer, it will make more sense. And so I think God is like that with miracles. So normally he doesn't break his rules. You have miracles of timing. But occasionally he'll break his rules if it makes more sense. And then let's have a look at the resurrection of Jesus, where I think all sorts of rules are broken. It's Jesus rising from the dead and then appearing to his disciples in, you know, behind locked doors. And then, you know, bodily ascending, you know, at the end when he had the ascension, gravity appears to have no effect. And so it seems like a lot of physical rules are broken then. And to go back to the key signature analogy, a composer sometimes does, for one or two bars, just breaks the rules and puts in a lot of different accidentals. And what he does, he changes the key signature for just one or two bars and then comes back to the normal key signature. And I think that's analogy of the resurrection. A lot of rules are broken. A new key signature was established for the risen Jesus. So his resurrected body looked like his original body. He was recognized, although not instantly by Mary, not instantly by the disciples on the road to Emmaus, but his body was not subject to death and decay anymore. And so he had a new body, like we're told our resurrected bodies will be when we die. And so I think it's like a change of key signature. And like a master composer is free to do this, he is free to break his own rules if it makes more sense. So I think the miracle like the resurrection. If you read what Peter said on the day of Pentecost, he said, God, death could not hold. If Jesus was the Son of God, death could not hold him. And so it makes more sense that he rose. And you can look at this, if you like a change of key signature where lots of laws are broken, but the composer is free to do this if it makes better music. So that's the analogy. Yeah,
and I thought that was one of the most helpful things I'd heard as a scientist. So I hope you thought that was worthwhile. But let's have some questions from the floor. One there. Dina will bring the microphone.
In 2 Kings 20, it records the Hezekiah asking that for a sign, and the sun is recorded as going backwards 10 steps instead of, sorry, the shadow of the sun is recorded as going backwards 10 steps instead of forward 10 steps. Do you have an explanation for that, please?
No, thank you. That's a really good question. And honesty is always a very good thing. And I don't have an explanation for that. But I will tell you, last year I would have said I don't have an explanation for the sun standing still. So I think, yeah, it's another puzzle. And there may be an explanation. I don't have one at the moment, yes. It's puzzling, yes.
There's a question over there.
Hi. I briefly heard something in the presentation which disturbed me a little bit, but I'm not sure I understood it correctly, concerning the last piece about the sun and the moon. And I thought I heard a reference to the moon eclipsing simultaneously as the sun did. Which of course is an impossibility.
Yes, of course. Yes, yes.
Because
if I said that, it was wrong. So it was a solar eclipse.
Sure.
And in a solar eclipse, as you're saying, it's precisely new moon time.
Yeah.
Called conjunction, as you know, yeah? So a solar eclipse happens when the sun and the moon and the earth are in direct line, and I think when Joshua said the sun stopped and the moon stopped, he meant that both have stopped shining, right? And indeed, at a solar eclipse, the sun stopped shining and the moon has stopped shining as well. I mean, the moon stopped reflecting the light from the sun, and it is strictly new moon time. It's not a lunar eclipse, it's a solar eclipse.
But
and
then the moon would not have been doing anything unusual.
No, the moon...
not shining because...
Yeah, it would have stopped shining, that's right.
But and, it's yeah. always the case at a solar eclipse yeah. with a new moon.
Yeah, yes, yeah. right. But that bit is actually integral to the story, because if you go back in the story starts with Joshua and his troops attacking people, I think, at Gibeon by night, and it's a nighttime attack, and the implication is a surprise attack, and it's a surprise attack because the moon's not shining, right? So that goes back to the start of the story. So, that the, yeah, yes.
Okay.
More questions? One over there.
In your first section on the story of Joseph, I just wondered whether you mentioned that there are ancient Near Eastern texts that said that the price of a slave would have been 20 shekels, and whether it's possible that the writers of Genesis would have had access to those texts, would have therefore researched them to find out that information.
Right, so that's a good question. So would the writer of that's a very good question. Would the writer of Genesis had access to knowledge of what the price of slaves were at that time? I don't know, but I very much doubt it. I think, you see, if the writer, let's say the writer of Genesis writing in 600 BC, how would he have known that Joseph was living at the time of Hyksos Pharaoh, you know, in 1600 BC? So how would we know? So that's the first thing we don't know. And also, then, you know, knowing the price of slaves at that time, might there have been some ancient library with this information in? I guess it's possible, so it's a good question. But I just think it's more likely that this story was either written down, or it could have been an oral tradition, and then was very faithfully transmitted. And so it was a reliable record, you know, even, and just updated, the language updated by the scribes. Yes, it's a good question, thank you.
On the back.
Hi, Colin. Here at the back.
Yeah, yes. Sir.
Hi. Have you come across the archaeological dig at Tel El Darba that some people say is the ancient city of Avaris? And some people, they found a statue of a non-Egyptian man there as part of a tomb complex behind a palace, and well, lots of people think that could be where Joseph lived. Have you come across that? And what do you
mean? No, I haven't. That's interesting. Yeah. So, and this was a tomb of a Hyksos Pharaoh, was it? Or
the title of the paper is "Statue of an Asiatic Man," which is a term used yes. for non-Egyptian.
Yeah. Right. Right. No, I haven't come across that, but I'd be interested if you tell me afterwards. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
He also is wearing a coat of multicolored coat as well.
Right, right. Okay, yes, thank you. Thank you.
I think there's one at the back, that side, and then another one up here in a moment.
Thank you for a great talk, sir. Can I ask about the timing of the water disappearing? So if the mudslide happens, because of how water finds a level, is it... I've always been intrigued that their foot touched and then it disappeared.
Right, right.
How does that work with a mudslide?
Right, okay. So that's a good question, that's right. So so I think, you see, what the text says, that the water was coming down in torrents, I think is what the Hebrew says, because it was in flood. And so I guess the water had a huge momentum going down, not the usual sort of, you know, normal momentum. It was rushing down. And so if there was a mudslide, the water below the mudslide, as it were, would have continued rushing down. So I think it could have dried out really quite rapidly like that, if you see what I mean. But so, yeah, good question.
One up the center aisle here.
Sorry, Colin, could you put my mind at rest? I'm scratching my head on the point of tree ring dating and just wondering how many trees still remain from thousands of years ago. And if you were so privileged and to actually have access to one, because I would have thought they would long have disappeared.
Right.
Long ago.
Right. No, thank you. Yes. Yeah, so that's a really good question. Tree ring dating goes back a surprisingly long length of time, and I think it goes back at least 4,000 years. Because what you do, you match. So the tree ring pattern, so you get thin rings, you know, fat rings when you get, you know, lots of rain and less rain and so on, and you match the sequence of rings in living and dead trees. So you start with the living trees which are alive now, and bristlecone pines in America go back, you know, many, many centuries. And so you establish a tree ring record, and you get the pattern of narrow rings and broad rings and so on, and you go back to the start of those trees, and then you look at trees which died some time ago, but the rings are still there, and you do a matching of those narrow and broad tree rings, and so you can actually go back on absolute terms about 4,000 years. So that's what you can do, and this is what has been done in that case. And it's not an isolated, set of trees. I mean, there's a number of trees who've done this. So it is a well-established record, actually. So it's a good question. But you match, you know, features in living trees back with features in dead trees and go back way in time. Yes.
One over there. Okay, just a comment on that. You don't need the trees, of course. You need wooden furniture. So if you find wooden furniture from that period, look at the rings in it.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
So you're not relying on trees that have lasted for 3,000 years, just furniture that has lasted that long.
Thank you very much. Yes, any piece of wood which still has the tree ring traces in, that is right. Thank you. Yes.
One here, and then one at the back there, I see.
Sorry, which one first?
Up here in the third row back, middle.
Thank you. Just going back to the first question about the shadow going the wrong way.
Yes.
I've never thought about this, but could there not be a wall of cloud which reflects the sun's light and then it would go the wrong way? I mean, that could be a possible explanation.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's a topic for you to research.
Yes. Yes. No, I know. Yes. 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 Thank you. Yes. You are right. So if you have a the edge of a cloud which is drifting the other way, then you would alter the appearance of the shadow. That is true. Yes, that's right. So it's a good thought. Thank you. Yes, yes.
Yeah. One right at the back, that side.
Oh, sorry.
There's two there, I think. One just there. That's...
Hi. Apart from the resurrection, is there any other miracle in the Bible that you would say was not explainable by a natural means that is definitely not playing in the normal key?
Right. Yes, thank you. So that's a good question. I mean, I would say that it appears that some of the healing miracles of Jesus appear to break natural laws, physical laws. I mean, maybe it's just lots of speeded up events, but they would appear to break natural laws. But, you know, there's this curious case of when Jesus cures a blind man, he cures this blind man and says, "Can you see okay?" And the man said, "I see people as trees walking," if you remember this. So it looks like astigmatism, right? So Jesus then did some more, as it were, and cured him. So it's like a two-stage process there. And that sort of suggested that some natural mechanisms may be being involved in that case. But I would say, healing miracles of Jesus. Or, for example, when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, if you believe that, then, of course, Lazarus was raised with his old body, as it were, and he then presumably went and died again, whereas Jesus was raised with a different body. Again, that would, I would think, be breaking physical laws.
I think one of the things about modern science is we see so many more complexities we had no idea about, that what would have seemed a miracle 100 years ago, it doesn't make it any more wonderful as part of God's creation, but it would have seemed miraculous 100 years ago.
That's right, that is right, yes.
There was another question down there somewhere. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, I was just going to say it's very informative and it's a great presentation, despite the typos or what have you. What I was going to ask is, or rather just say, are you aware of the eclipse of the 21st of August and how that relates to the sign of Jonah? And how, and what's your opinion of that? And the scheduled eclipse that's going to happen in another 7 years' time, making the kind of like X sign over America, and whether or not you're aware of that, because it kind of travelled diagonally from Salem all the way through to Florida or what have you, and or Jerusalem, you know what I mean? And then it's going to go the opposite way from Washington in 7 years' time, and just what you think of that, and how it being perhaps potentially the sign of Jonah shown to the adulterous generation or what have you, you know what I mean, in the end times. I don't know. I just thought I'd postulate that. But yeah, thank you once again. It was a great speech. Mm.
Noah, thank you. So I'm not very familiar with this, but I think you're referring to some future eclipses or recent eclipses, which may have some particular significance. Yeah. So I'm not familiar with that. That's interesting, though. Thank you.
I've got a friend. Thank you for your talk, actually. It's a wonderful to see that there are ways God can come into things and time things exactly. But I've got a friend who's a scientist and a Christian, but he finds it difficult, the turning of the water into wine, because he's worked as an industrial chemist for Guinness, and he knows you can't get wine out of water. But had you got any reflection on that?
Right. Well, let's thank you. So again, I don't know what happened there, right? And I think it's good to be honest. And so I don't, but I will think about it. Yes. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, only John records that miracle, but on the other hand, it is the first miracle that John says he performed, you know? So, so it needs more thought. Thank you, though. Yes, I don't know what happened to that.
On here. Just if you wait for the microphone, thank you.
Thank you for your talk. At what point in Genesis do you think it turns from being a myth to being a potentially historical document?
Right, yes. So the question is, what point in Genesis it turned from being a myth to being historical, essentially? So, well, I think everyone here knows this is a point on which Christians disagree. I would say that, as many people say, that I think we can say with some certainty, I would say, that from Genesis chapter 12 onwards, with Abraham, that's really meant to be historical. And then going back earlier in time, this is again Christians disagree, if you regard the flood as a local flood, and although the Bible says in the world it would mean their world, and there's clear evidence of local floods and massive local floods in those regions. The Genesis creation story, new interpretations come of these stories, and there's a very interesting new interpretation by quite distinguished theologian called John Walton in America, who says that this story should be interpreted literally, but in the sense that it was not a material creation being described, but a functional creation. And if you look at the Babylonian creation stories, I mean, then they talk in terms of functional creations. And let me just explain very quickly. So basically, when we think of a chair, I'm looking at that chair, I see something made of wood and steel, right? What he says, if you're an ancient Israelite, or an ancient Egyptian, or an ancient Babylonian, you'd look at that chair and you'll say, that's for someone to sit on. So they thought in terms of function, and we think much more in terms of physical objects. But we also think in terms of function. So we talk about creating a symphony, and if I talk about creating a symphony, you don't think of me thinking about writing down music on a piece of paper. You think of me thinking about the symphony in my head, right? Or if I'm, when I prepared this talk, and I prepared these overheads, which sometimes don't work, I prepared the overheads. I mean, the creative act wasn't actually doing the typing. The creative act, if you like, was, you know, thinking ahead. And so what John Walton says is that Genesis, interpreted literally in the correct way, God was taking an existing creation, which he'd done beforehand, right, and giving functions to the various things created. And just to give one small example, then I'll finish, and that is, there's this curious, first day of creation is light. Fourth day of creation is a sun and moon. Now, the ancient Israelites were not stupid, right? They knew that you needed the sun to give light by day and the moon to give reflected light by night. And he says, and then if you look at what's said about the sun and moon created, they're created for seasons and for months and for days, right? And so it's the function he's giving to them. And I think that's well worth thinking. So a literal interpretation in terms of function, not in terms of the actual material body that's there. So, right.
There's a question in the middle there.
Colin, do you give your talk to largely Jewish audiences? And I wonder if they have a different reaction to their interpretation of the Old Testament to when you're addressing mainly Christian audiences.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think Christians have, not always, of course, but Christians have largely ignored Jewish literature in looking at the Old Testament, and we shouldn't do that because of the insights they have. I have spoken to Jewish audiences. I've spoken about the Exodus to the biggest synagogue in New York State, which is in Albany, is several thousand people. This is a very big audience, but that audience is just huge. I was asked to talk about the Exodus there. They would like a functional idea of Genesis, I think, for the first few chapters of Genesis. But we need to look at Jewish literature quite a bit. When I wrote my Exodus book, I looked at several Jewish commentaries and books. So it's a particularly good book, I think, on the book of Exodus by someone called Sana, who's a Jewish person. But you're right, we should look at the Jewish literature, yes.
We may be getting close. There's one at the Rogers up here at the front.
So Alan Millard came and gave a talk and mentioned you at the last Christians in Science meeting in Bristol. And regarding your Exodus book, he didn't really agree with what you wrote there. But I think he made a comment saying he's not sure that you do now either. And I wonder if you could say whether you do or you don't.
Right, okay, yes. So, right, I know what he meant, right, because he actually asked me, so do you still agree with everything you wrote in your book about the Exodus, right? And I said, new information has come to light in some places. So I wrote this book about the Exodus and Exodus route, and I think the most controversial conclusion was that Mount Sinai is probably not at the traditional location in the Sinai Peninsula, which the evidence is weak. And I suggested it was in Arabia, in fact. And I still believe that. And not the Arabia site that some people think about, but the Arabia site, which really is a volcano. Because the description of Mount Sinai, you know, smoke and fire on the top, and an earthquakes, and lightning, which you get from a volcano, and the sound of trumpets, which you get from volcano. It's the gases being forced through, you know, cracks in the rocks. So I think that the place where I would like to revisit, and I haven't had time to do it, is the site of the Red Sea crossing. Because when I wrote the book, I said that mechanism was wind set down, a natural mechanism, and I thought that it could only apply in the Gulf of Aqaba. And that still may be correct, but I think I didn't take into account that the geometry of the inland lakes was different 3,000 years ago than it is now. And if you take that into account, it is possible that an inland lake could be the site of the Red Sea crossing. But I don't know. I think that is a possibility. But more information has come, and I'd quite like to write another book on that subject. Have a look at it again, yes.
And, of course, this is the scientific process, isn't it?
It is. I mean,
we have to constantly refine our views. Right. Is the one last question, or are we going to... I think... all right, Paul has got a good question.
I was interested with the dating of the Egyptian dynasties, and I've already forgotten the chap's name, Metenpar or
Menepta. Menepta. Yes.
And he was the son of Ramesses II.
Yes.
And there's been quite a lot of disagreement as to whether Ramesses II was the pharaoh of the Exodus, Moses.
Yes.
Your dating would seem to bring him back as a really strong candidate for that.
Yes. Right.
So, yeah, is that what you're suggesting?
That's right. So I think there's been someone called David Roll who's had television programs, a lot of publicity, and I appreciate what he's done because he's a really independent thinker, and he's saying that the dates of Egyptian pharaohs should be brought forward, you know, by 300 years or so. And I don't agree with him on that. I think the evidence doesn't support that. And then particularly this radiocarbon dating, you know, which is fairly recent, 2010 put together, I think that makes it clear to me that he just cannot be right. And so that would then mean that the pharaoh at the Exodus was Ramesses II, yes. And when Joshua went in, Meneptah, yes. Yeah.
Well, I think we should call it an end. It's been a wonderful evening and very informative. Thank you so much, Colin. I think I'm right in saying that Einstein said he was blessed with the gift of curiosity. And the thing that's really amazed me is your curiosity is not just directed at the scientific process in your research, but you're able to apply it to the picture of Scripture and how we understand it. And that is really very, very helpful for all of us. And I think it gives us renewed confidence in the Scriptures we hold so dear. So thank you very much indeed for this evening.
Thank you, Andrew. Yes. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming, everyone. Just to say, the donations basket's still at the back, and we've got the leaflets for the flyer. But I just want to give the last word to Paul and give us a vote of thanks.
Thank you, Andrew.
I suspect Andrew has already given a vote of thanks to the speaker, but it was so good it can be worth another one. I'm hoping his PC, Mac, or whatever it was, something has slightly messed up our heating this evening, so I apologise for that. You know what church is like. It's always the vicar's fault, so I will say sorry for that. Colin was reminding me over supper earlier that, I think his talk tonight would have been absolutely amazing if he was a full-time biblical scholar. The fact is, he does all this work in airport lounges and on planes. And so it's even more remarkable in today's world to have such a polyglot and a scholar among us. So can we once again just thank Colin for a marvellous evening. Thank you very much indeed.